It's brand new, season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to the one and only Ryan Seacrest.
Love the connection to people. I think at the core, what I get excited about, what gets me up in the morning, is connecting with people in an unscripted, unvarnished way. Is getting to say something to them, hear back from them, know that I'm part of the routine, and I look forward to getting on the air. I look forward to it.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, by rocket to the moon, by airplane to the rocket, by taxi to the airport, by front door to the taxi, by throwing back the blanket hanging down the legs. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
That's a They Might Be Giants quote.
Oh. Somehow that makes sense.
It's a great song. I'll play it for you after the show.
Excellent.
All right, so today we wanted to talk. We're still talking about space exploration. If you heard our previous podcast, we were talking about the benefits and risks of manned space exploration versus unmanned space exploration. And today we want to talk a little bit more about the idea of colonization, not just exploring space, but finding other places where we could live and do science and stay there for prolonged periods of time, not just for a short visit and then pop right back.
Get a good butt groove going on your space couch.
Yeah, you need to. Yeah, exactly. Get it so that you can sit there and essentially say,
that's this the definition, isn't it? Yeah. Or when you live somewhere.
Like, this place is mine. Not only do I have a flag, check out the butt groove. It's not going to fit your butt, I guarantee it. Can space become home? That's really the question we're asking. And the two main candidates that I think most people think about when we talk about colonization, at least in the, foreseeable future, like within the next few decades, would be either Earth's moon or Mars. Those seem to be the two leading candidates, wouldn't you agree?
Yeah.
So, well,
they're, cooler than Mercury, less totally poisonous than Venus.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true.
Okay, so as we talked about in our last podcast, it's going to be mega dangerous to go there. So
because space wants to kill you.
Yes, space wants to kill you. Anytime you leave Earth, you're taking a big risk. So what are the benefits? Why would people want to create colonies on the moon and Mars?
Well, I can give you some overview about the moon specifically. I mean, NASA was looking at the possibility of going back to the moon, and in fact ended up having a project in 2006 called Why the Moon? You know, why would we go back there?
And it's there.
They came up with more than they actually asked people all around the world. Like, they were asking leading scientists and engineers as well as other people, you know, thinkers, authors, all sorts. Not to say that authors don't think all that often. I'm the son of an author. It's just a joke at my dad. So they asked all these folks, like, you know, why should we go back to the moon? And ended up compiling a list of over 200 reasons, or more than 200 reasons, I should say. And but they generally fell into certain major categories. So for the moon specifically, they said that they talked about just the idea of having a human settlement beyond Earth. This idea that this is another frontier that we can explore and make a home on. And that's a powerful idea all on its own, right?
Getting our foot in the door.
Yeah.
Or out the door.
And that could apply not just to the moon, obviously. That could apply to any body that's out in space. But specifically they were referring to the moon in this case. They also said that you could pursue scientific study to answer questions about the history of the Earth, the history of our solar system, and the history of the universe, and what our place is within that context. You know, these are big questions, and sometimes to get perspective, you got to leave stuff behind, you know, like our planet. And we could learn more about the actual history of the moon, like how was the moon formed? We've got lots of theories on it, but this would help us test those theories and see if the theories seem to hold true based upon the observations we can make there. Beyond that, they said that you could test technologies, systems, and processes that we'd use for deeper space exploration and support future missions to other places like Mars and beyond. So in other words, use the moon as a test bed so that we can learn, we've created the best practices that we need to make space exploration as safe and scientifically profitable as possible.
Not just a test bed, but it would be an important staging point for actual missions, right?
Sure, yeah. You're talking about 1/6 the gravity of Earth.
Right.
So
much easier to launch from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Compared to Earth, it is far easier to get a vehicle off the surface of the moon than it is on Earth. So if you were able to ship materials to the moon and then put those materials together and then launch a ship from the moon, then you could use that as a staging ground, a launch pad, really. So you could use that to go on deeper space exploration missions, whether those are manned or unmanned. You could even, you know, launch unmanned missions from the moon if you wanted to. Beyond that, it would provide a challenging objective that would require global cooperation and participation in a peaceful way. In other words, this is something that goes well beyond the capabilities of any one nation. It would be a global effort. And the idea being that if you can create a challenge, a task that requires cooperation on this global scale, so we're talking about a peaceful effort where we can get some cooperation around the entire world to meet this incredible challenge at hand.
That's one of the things that programs like the Apollo are lauded for, you know, for even just within a single nation, bringing people together and making people figure out how to work, you know, between governments and corporations and
yeah. Although the Apollo program certainly has, it's also the other political side, which was it was part of the space race where mm-hmm. it was almost an attempt.
Confrontational
thing between the United States and the Soviet Union.
Maybe it's wrong. I think I've read, though, people interpreting it in a kind of generous light, saying that the space race gave us a way to express our sort of international competitive instinct in a way that was not violent.
It's sort
That's
of
true.
Like the Olympics, but with a more, you know, nuclear threat behind
yeah.
it.
Yeah. I was about to say, because when you think about it, the other side of the space race is saying, hey, I can put this thing into orbit,
yeah.
so you better bet I can put it into Moscow or,
yeah.
you know, Washington, D.C., depending
yeah.
upon
yeah.
which part you're in. So, but this would be a way of saying, instead of it being pitting one nation against another in a race to get to a finish line, it's more saying, this is a challenge that's worthy of us. Let's band together and meet it. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of an attempt to take that same sort of spirit of competition, but instead of working against each other, we're working against an external challenge that is pretty significant.
The sheer scientific findings, we were talking a little bit about those in the previous episode, but, sure. But you know, the necessities that human beings have in those kind of environments, you know, it's up on the International Space Station, they've got a water filtration system that can effectively recycle up to 95% of all onboard water, including your urine, sweat, and tears.
Yeah. Like the water vapor you breathe out could end up being recycled.
Yeah. Which, you know, is a little bit water world, but other than that is a terrific scientific advancement.
Yeah. So, I mean, that sort of stuff, the things that would become a necessity for us just to make this work could end up in, you know, inspiring technology or directly spawning technology here on Earth that benefits everybody in some other way. And the only way you really get that benefit is if you really back the initiative to trying to do this. Beyond that, it also expands Earth's economic sphere to the moon. So, like, in other words, we literally increase our potential wealth by including the moon as part of that. And you know, you might think, like, well, what the heck is on the moon?
Yeah, what's good to get there?
Well, I mean, real estate is a steal right now. But
You know about that guy who's selling
it,
right?
Yes, I do. I know about that guy who's selling it. But
if you're listening and you're tempted to buy a plot of land on the moon, don't do it.
No.
It's a shady deal.
Yeah. The claim,
that deed will probably not be honored.
Right. But there is stuff on the moon that could be very useful. There was a discovery that the regolith, that's the dirt, essentially the
moon
soil
dirt
that is on the moon. It's also what we call really any
extraterrestrial
dirt. Yeah.
Dirt.
Mars has regolith as well. But the regolith on the moon contains helium-3 in concentrations much greater than you would find here on Earth.
And helium, aside from being completely wasted as a children's toy in
or
balloons.
Or an awesome way to make your voice sound funny.
Yeah, you sound awesome.
Yeah, I sure do.
Should do a whole episode on helium.
Yeah, but you mean literally like we're on helium while we're doing the episode? It would have to be short because we could asphyxiate. But anyway, what you were going to say is that helium has lots of scientific uses, right?
Right, absolutely.
For example, you can use helium to cool things. You know, use liquid helium. You can use that to cool scientific equipment that needs to be close to absolute
to
zero.
To super cool things.
Yeah. Helium-3 can get things within a few thousandths of a Kelvin, like a single Kelvin, like less than one Kelvin. Zero Kelvin is absolute zero. That means there is no molecular movement.
Isn't helium-3 potentially useful in fusion?
It is also potentially useful for fusion. Now, helium-3, because it's non-radioactive, means that you could use that as a potential fuel in fusion reactors and not have to worry about dealing with radiation. And you could it essentially starts to produce protons as its byproduct, but you can control protons with a magnetic field. You can actually contain protons that way. So while it's giving off protons at high speeds during these fusion reactions, you could harness the energy and minimize any risk relatively easy if you have enough helium. When I say relatively, this is still an incredibly complicated thing, but it's access to that helium would make this much easier than it is right now. It's also important for detecting things like neutrons, which you might not think is that important unless you happen to be checking for any sort of illegal smuggled plutonium, which gives off neutrons as it decays. So it's a very effective detection method for things like neutrons, but we don't have a lot of it here on Earth. The moon has lots of it from what we can tell. It may be that shady parts of the moon have a lot more of it than the sunny parts of the moon, but at any rate, there is the possibility that we could end up using the moon as a resource for helium-3.
Hmm.
And then there is the whole idea of inspiring future generations of students to really focus on STEM fields.
Yeah.
So that, you know, all the science and technology, engineering and math, disciplines that could benefit from, you know, students just flooding it because there's this this initiative to build a colony on the moon. All of these are big reasons. And of course, like I said, they listed more than 200 total, and they all kind of fell into these broad categories. So that's sort of why we would want to look at the moon. And now, what about why we would want to go to Mars? A lot of the reasons are going to be similar. Things like the inspiring the generation of people. I mean, that's clearly going to be play a part. Science and technology would obviously play a part.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And also, it would again be another global effort. Mars is that is not a small task either. Now, keep in mind, the moon is about 238,900 miles away, or 384,400 kilometers from Earth.
On average, right?
Yeah. Mars, when it's at its closest point, keep in mind that the orbital path of Earth and Mars means that sometimes they are
quite far away.
They can be on opposite sides of the sun. Yeah, which means that Mars is further away from Earth than the sun would be. Well, at its closest point, it is about 33,927,000 miles away, or around 54,600,000 kilometers. At its furthest point, it is 249,200,000 miles away, or 401 million kilometers. On average, it's about 139,800,000 miles, or 225 million kilometers. So it's much further away than the moon, and that presents one of the many, many challenges when you compare the two. Not to say that either would be a cakewalk, but there are some extra considerations you have to make depending upon which place you're choosing.
Sure. As a launch pad, you know, it could, when it's further out than Earth to, or closer, I suppose, at that point, than Earth to certain things, that could be pretty cool.
Yeah. You have to account, if you're launching anything from Mars, you have to account for Mars's gravitational effect, which is not as big as Earth's. It's around 62% of Earth's, but still much greater than the moon's, which is 1/6 that of Earth's. So you still have to battle against gravity. You also have an atmosphere, although it's a thin one on Mars, and that can, you know, that also plays into the whole launch aspect and reentry and all that kind of stuff. So Mars as a launching pad is certainly a possibility if you were able to build out a colony of sufficient complexity, but it would be a larger challenge than to do the same thing on the moon.
Also, we're not sure what we could get resource-wise out of Mars yet. We don't have enough data to really say.
Yeah. If we want a lot of stuff that's oxidized, then we can get plenty of that. But that might not be that. I mean, we can rust stuff here on Earth.
I mean, there might be really cool stuff.
There could be.
Well, I mean, one advantage of a colony on Mars is that Mars is potentially the bigger research prize than the moon.
Sure.
Because nobody really thinks we're going to find evidence of life on the moon. But it's, who knows, you know, we might find evidence on Mars that there was once microbial life on the surface.
Yeah, those canals didn't pan out. So maybe we'll actually see some microbial, or at least some evidence of microbial life on Mars. But that would...
Hopefully that we didn't bring ourselves.
Yeah.
But, you know,
yeah,
fingers crossed.
That's
well,
a good...
That's something we'll talk about in a minute
reference
here.
Reference as well, yeah. So there are definitely benefits for either. And I think that, you know, we've always dreamed of exploring other maybe always is the wrong word, but as long as I can remember, we've dreamed of exploring.
We probably didn't dream of exploring like the bodies of gods that were crossing the sky.
Probably not. But you know, now we're definitely at that point. Although we call those bodies of gods rockets. but we're at the point now where we do dream of the exploration and establishment of a colony somewhere else. And I think Mars has its own appeal, because while there are some major challenges that we're going to have to talk about in a minute, the fact that it is in some ways much more similar to Earth than the moon is, I mean, there is an atmosphere, even though it's not a breathable atmosphere, it's not very thick. And there is more gravity on Mars, although it's not as great as Earth's gravity, then, it kind of feels like that would be a better fit in some ways. So that kind of leads us into a discussion about what the challenges are of establishing colonies at either the moon or Mars. And they share some stuff in common, but there are also some very, you know, there's some things that are peculiar to just one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, First problem is getting there. Now, getting to the moon is significantly less difficult than getting to Mars. Yeah,
so it's a couple days.
Yeah. Getting to the moon is a few days, whereas getting to Mars, depending upon where Mars and Earth are along their orbits.
And, you know, hopefully we would sync that up so that it was a shorter trip.
The best estimate's about 180 days, right?
Yeah. Generally, like 6 months tends to be the shortest of short. And even then, you're not aiming at where Mars is. You're aiming at where it's going to be, right? Mm-hmm. You have to do a trajectory of where Mars will be by the time your spacecraft gets to that point in space.
We discussed last time what happens to your body while you're in space on transit to in transit to Mars. 180 days in interplanetary space is not very cool.
As it turns out, there's a lot of radiation going on in space.
Yeah, there's solar radiation, there's cosmic radiation, you know, cosmic rays. These are nasty things to encounter. It's not something you want to be exposed to for very long. So it means that either you would have to shield your spacecraft in such a way so that it could block the majority of this radiation, which adds weight to your spacecraft and makes it more difficult for you to have to launch it, or you just have to endure the danger of traveling through that. Now,
That's just kind of a non-starter. Like,
yeah.
You just have to find a way to shield the astronauts.
Right. There was one study that was done by the FAA, actually, back in 2005, that said that if you were to take a journey to Mars and back, now this was a thought of if we were to visit Mars but then ultimately return to Earth, as we'll discuss later on in the podcast. Now the look at going to Mars essentially means a one-way ticket, because the difficulty of getting someone back to Earth is so great that it would push back the mission many more years for us to be able to do that. So the FAA estimated that it would take about 536 days in space total to get to Mars and back. Because remember, those both planets are continuing to travel through space while you're going on this mission, which means that by the time you land on Mars, Earth is not where you thought it was going to be. Like, so you actually have to wait for the planets to start to line up again so that you can optimize your travel time. Otherwise, you have to worry about how much more fuel you're going to carry, which again changes all the other parameters of mission. It's really complicated, in other words. Like, one change to one thing changes everything else. They said that they estimated someone who would be between 25 and 34 years old would have a 10% chance of contracting cancer if you're male. If you're female, it's 17%. So that's a significant number. That's just the trip. So Mars, as it turns out, does not have enough of an atmosphere to really block a lot of this nasty radiation, and it doesn't have a magnetosphere to repel cosmic rays. So,
right, and cosmic rays are thought to possibly lead to diseases like Alzheimer's.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, it's not just cancer. There are a lot of nasty things that can happen to you upon exposure to this stuff. You are vulnerable to it while you are traveling to Mars, and you would still be vulnerable on the surface of Mars. We'll talk about a proposed mission to Mars and how they are talking about trying to keep people safe from this kind of radiation. But the point is, that's something you got to worry about. Now, the moon benefits from being close enough to the Earth where not all of this radiation is going to hit the moon, but it's still quite a bit still does hit the moon.
Yeah, the moon is from what I read, and maybe I'm wrong, I thought the moon was pretty much just as bad a radiation situation as the surface of Mars, but
it's different because of the lack of atmosphere. That mm-hmm. certainly plays a huge role with the moon.
The advantage is the length of the trip, right?
Right, yeah, you're talking
you're
about a few days.
Exposed yeah. as long on the way there.
And you could hypothetically come home within a certain period of time to minimize your exposure.
Exactly, yeah. So if we're talking about in both cases that they could build a surface on the structure that would protect you from the radiation.
Or under the ground.
Yeah. Build a surface on the structure. I think that's what I said. Build a structure on the surface. Sorry. That would keep you safe in either place, but the trip to Mars is unavoidable. It's going to be long, even in the best case.
Sure.
Now, some other challenges to discuss. We've also said in the last podcast about how long exposure to microgravity can result in other problems, things like your
muscle degeneration, bone loss,
your body fluids redistribute, and you can start to have cardiovascular and blood pressure problems. Now, on a trip to Mars, that's dangerous. Once you get to Mars, the gravity is a little bit better, so you could avoid some of those problems. The moon, 1/6 the Earth's gravity, so some of those problems would remain big concerns. Like, if you spent any appreciable amount of time on the moon and then came back to Earth, you'd probably feel like you were wearing lead clothing. Mm-hmm. And it's possible that you could be suffering from some of these problems, like muscle loss and bone loss, that and muscle loss you can recover from, but bone loss is something that is pretty, pretty much permanent.
Under current medical technology, yeah, there's no coming back.
Now, maybe by the time we actually have a colony on the moon, we can fix that. We'll have, like, Dr. McCoy's little medical device that will magically restore bone loss. But right now, we don't have that. Both of those trips would have those issues as well. Now, once you got to Mars, you probably could avoid some of the muscle loss and bone loss stuff. But on the trip there, you'd still have to deal with it. You don't have a breathable atmosphere in either location, so you have to make sure that you bring something with you. Now, in the case of the moon, you pretty much have to bring all of it. And then continually resupply. With Mars, there's talk of the fact that you might be able to get ice from Mars and then treat it so that you could make it a breathable atmosphere. But you would have to treat it because the stuff that is on Mars is not friendly to human lungs.
Oh, yeah. That's another problem with Mars, isn't it? It's right. Got some stuff there that our bodies don't like.
Yeah. The Mars regolith, as it turns out, is pretty toxic overall. There are a lot of words here that I do not know how to say at all. Okay.
Poison dust.
Silicates.
Silicates, yeah. Silicates are stuff that react with water to form things like hydrogen peroxide, hydroxyl, and superoxide. And BT dubs, water is in our lungs.
Yeah.
So when you breathe silicates in, quartz,
they get fizzy.
Quartz dust does the same thing, and it's blamed for lung cancer and silicosis in miners.
Yes.
Which is a terrible lung disease.
Yeah.
Gypsum is a sulfate material that forms again in the presence of water. It's not technically toxic, but it's an extreme eye, skin, and respiratory irritant, like on the level of coal dust. Perchlorate? Yes. There you go. That
hard
one.
See.
It's which is a group of chemicals that are used as oxidizers in rocket fuel, which can basically break down the thyroid gland too.
Dang.
So you have to make sure that whatever environment you have, you are completely free of these contaminants that could otherwise kill you, these toxic things that could kill you.
And it's not like you're going to be running around barefoot in this stuff or anything.
But still, you'd have to imagine that...
The cleansing process to get it, like anything that you took in from outside would have to go through the kind of decontamination.
Yeah, it would be the space version of delousing. It would be this incredibly thorough process. It would have to be in order for you to avoid contaminating the habitable areas of the colony.
And maybe this gives us a moment to talk about what is actually feasible in terms of a habitable environment on these planets, the moon and the planet Mars. We're not talking about these big space cities like you see in the movies. I mean, in the near future, we're basically talking about living in a can.
Yeah, maybe a few cans that are connected by tubes.
Underground cans.
Yeah,
well, yeah, especially for Mars, it would have to be. And we'll talk about the specific one. Mars 1 is the one we'll specifically talk about. But, the moon would probably be a good idea, too, just so that you could avoid that radiation problem. Mm-hmm. But the other big issue, of course, with Mars is that it is so far away that, we could send materials there, but it's going to take the better part of a year to get there, depending upon where Earth and Mars are in their orbits.
So if you left your phone charger.
Yeah, or food.
Or food, right.
Or you realize that your oxygen-making equipment isn't making oxygen at the rate that you need it, then you're not in good shape.
Mentioning food, this brings up another thing that's pretty interesting. I read in a Slate article about Mars colonization One issue is that we don't know what the long-term effects of being separated from Earth bacteria are,
right,
on the diet. Like, there's soil bacteria all over the Earth,
mm-hmm,
and having good biodiversity of bacteria in the soil is apparently important for growing the kinds of crops that keep our gut flora healthy.
Right. There's a project called the Human Microbiome Project that has found that bacterial cells outnumber our cells in our own bodies like 10 to 1.
Yeah.
We've got something like 100 trillion bacteria living in us at any given time.
So really, we're not so much human as we are bacteria planets.
Yes, we are giant bacteria bags.
Well, by mass, we're a lot. We outnumber but our cells are bigger.
We outmass
so
bacteria.
We can rough it up, is what you're telling me.
But yeah. But any given human contains up to like 10,000 strains of bacteria, and all of those are different depending on what you eat and where you live. Like for example, if you eat a bunch of sushi, there's a bacteria for that helps you break down the seaweed.
There's a bacteria for that.
Yeah,
it's much better than there's an app for that.
If you're on Mars and you're eating food grown hydroponically on Mars, you're not getting that biodiversity.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It has none of the, if you're just growing out of water, you don't have that soil. And it would be just fantastically expensive to ship dirt to Mars.
And whether or not those bacteria could even live in those environments that we're artificially creating for ourselves,
yeah,
is a question.
Yeah. So those are the challenges. Let's talk a little bit about some of the proposed missions that either will or would or could have put a colony on Mars or the moon.
Well, okay. And this kind of ties back into the challenges as well, because the costs of doing all of this stuff,
yeah,
is large and the estimates.
Would you say astronomical?
Oh dear. See, I was avoiding that word, but there you go.
grinning at me like an idiot.
I am an idiot.
Looking at going to the moon, back in 2004, that why the moon kind of concept. The initial estimates were between about $100 billion through 2020. But other people said that it could cost somewhere between $250 to $500 billion.
And the Constellation program, which was a program that NASA had proposed back in the mid 2000s, that would have been our moon colony and future deep space exploration program. One of the major criticisms leveled against that program was that it was already going over budget and it was behind schedule. And so it may have been that $100 billion estimate was in fact low. I mean, it's hard to say when you first come up with these things, because a lot of the challenges you will discover as you embark upon these projects aren't known at the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. You start to discover them as you go along, and then you realize, oh, now I have to take this into consideration. Wait a minute. Now that I know this one piece of information, that affects these other 14 things I thought I knew before.
Right. And if I don't have any of the numbers in front of me, but if you look at any of the NASA programs, most of them have gone tremendously over budget and not in those, you know, like government spending kind of ways, just because of what you were saying,
right,
Jonathan.
Yeah. I mean, not to say that every NASA program has been a model of efficient management, because there are certainly cases of mismanagement within the space program. But it's not like that's the one and only factor that leads to a project going over budget.
Sure. And in contrast, the Mars One cost, which is one of the projects we're probably about to talk about in detail, their estimated cost is about $6 billion for the first colony of 4 people.
This makes no sense to me.
Which is ridiculous.
$6 billion.
Although Elon Musk roughly estimated a Mars colony at only $36 billion. And I would say
they all had to go in Teslas.
Right.
You had to just get in a Tesla and launch it into space, and then you could drive there. And the nice thing is it's a silent ride. What?
But I'm not grinning
like an idiot. Well, now I am, but I wasn't before.
Okay.
But it's ridiculous. I it's crazy to me that the people are estimating going to Mars in this 6 billion, this 36 billion numbers, when we were talking about going to the moon, almost a decade ago for $250 billion.
Yeah, it's...
Well, they're going to finance it by reality TV, so what's the problem?
All right, well, before we get into that, let me talk about the moon one first.
Okay.
Because this kind of predates the Mars One circus. I think it's safe to call it a circus, right?
No,
do you think it's being unfair?
I don't want to throw a wet blanket on Mars One. I'm just saying I'm very skeptical. I don't want to be a downer and say, don't try. I'm just saying, I don't know how you're going to do this.
Yeah, we'll get into that. We'll talk about the Mars One fiasco in a minute. So, I'm sorry. My brain switched off. Now let's talk about the moon for a second. So NASA had the Constellation program that they had proposed where it would, the idea was to create a crew exploration vehicle, which was eventually named the Orion. And the Orion crew exploration vehicle was to replace the previous methods of delivering people into space, and also to create a new type of heavy lifting vehicle, essentially a rocket, so that that would replace what in the Constellation program was the Ares V rocket. So the Constellation program was meant to establish a presence on the moon, a colony on the moon, and then further go into space, perhaps eventually exploring and maybe even colonizing Mars and beyond. That was the idea. And some of the missions would be, unmanned missions that we would fire off from the moon and et cetera. The problem was that the budget, it went over budget. It was behind schedule. It had been criticized widely because it can be very difficult for scientists to justify the cost in the eyes of politicians and their constituents who don't see an immediate return on investment. It's not to say that people all undervalue what science brings to us and they don't realize it. It's just that it's a tough sell.
Oh, sure. When you're going, like healthcare and food,
education,
versus education.
Like that. Yeah. And I mean, granted, the work that we do in these endeavors can often benefit us in those arenas, but it's hard to make that direct connection when you are just trying to justify an enormous price tag, right? So NASA eventually, first they shelved the program, and then essentially the Obama administration scrapped it. So the Constellation program is no more. The crew exploration vehicle lives on, the Orion. That has continued to be funded and developed, although now the focus, at least in the short term, is less on the Orion being an exploration vehicle and more for being an alternative to an escape pod for the ISS folks, the International Space Station folks. So that way we don't have to depend upon the Russian Soyuz capsules. Instead, we have our very own capsules we could use. And then there's also that heavy lifting vehicle that is still being funded, which would be used to put crew and cargo and heavy supplies out into space. It'd be a necessary part of deep space exploration. There's been a lot of criticisms directed toward the Obama administration for putting that into motion because a lot of people said that really the Ares V rocket would have done all of that, and that if we had stuck with the Constellation program, we would already be preparing people to go out into space. Like within the next 2 years, we could have had someone on Mars. That's the argument that the critics have made toward this program. Where the truth lies, I don't know, because this is a complex issue. We've got a lot more than just the science and technology going on. You've got politics and economics, and eventually you get well beyond my level of expertise. So I don't know which side is the more realistic, but it certainly does not look like we're going to have a lunar colony there anytime in the near future. Maybe we do within, 2020 is this close as I would go. I know that Obama had talked about even establishing a presence on an asteroid by 2025 in preparation to landing people on Mars by 2035, sometime around then. There have been a lot of critics saying that how can you expect us to do that when you essentially hit reset on the program we had designed to do those things? Meanwhile, Mars One. So Mars One is a totally different animal. It's a private approach as opposed to a government-sponsored approach.
Right.
And it's a one-way ticket.
Yeah. You do not come back. At least there's no immediate
There's
plan.
There's no plan. Because,
right.
You know, maybe you would.
Maybe you would live long enough for us to develop a way to get you back. But that the plan is that once you go, that's where you're going to be spending the rest of your days. It's on that red planet.
It's run by technically a non-profit foundation that is run by a for-profit group.
Yeah, well, really what you have is you've got a for-profit arm that does all the merchandising and, like we said, TV reality show. That's supposed to be the main...
I wasn't kidding.
No, that's supposed to be the main way for generating revenue. The TV reality show and merchandising would generate the revenue needed to pour into the research, development, production, and execution of this project.
Yeah,
so
yeah. The idea is that through the applicant process and through the launch and through the settlement, you would be... You know, doing a reality TV series of what these people are going through.
You would have a Mars One Big Brother, essentially, mm-hmm. is from the very beginning where you have the selection process through the training process. And that training would probably involve putting applicants into hostile environments where they have to pretty much spend all their time within kind of like a biodome experience, you know, but put them someplace where they really could not venture beyond their stations because they would die. So mm-hmm. something like Antarctica or whatever, you know, put mm-hmm. them someplace where it'd be really tough to survive so that...
Which, for training purposes,
right.
But also it makes great television, folks. Yeah. I mean, in the way that... interesting fact, I'm pretty sure that the... Soviet cosmonauts were banned from playing chess after someone in Antarctica killed someone over the outcome of a chess match.
Wow, that's...
So this is the kind of TV that we can look forward to on the Mars One project.
Yikes.
All right.
So this does raise questions, obviously. Like, let's say that everything goes really well, and despite the myriad of challenges we mentioned, not to mention all the other challenges based upon the actual Mars One
microgravity,
approach.
Microgravity, radiation. The
fact that they have to build these, like, well, they'll build the capsules and send them to Mars. That's the mm-hmm. plan, right? And the capsules land on the surface of Mars. Rovers that they also put on the surface of Mars help bring those capsules to where they need to be.
Uh-huh.
And then astronauts and the rovers together, the first group of astronauts, the first group of four.
Right.
Would land on Mars. And with the
around
rovers.
Around 2030.
Yeah. So around the same time as what Obama's plan would do through the new NASA initiative. They would use the rovers to help build the living space they would need. So essentially the rovers and the first group of four would be in charge of putting together all the habitable space for the next group of four and the next group of four. I think there's 20 total. Is it 20?
The plan was to send out another four people every so often, every couple of years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, at any rate, the idea being the first four would have the most palatial estate for a while because they'd be the ones in charge of putting it all together. But, you know, to address that issue of radiation and the fact that they don't have the protection on the surface of Mars that we do on Earth, that talked about burying, you know, digging underground and putting some of the stations there, some of the, like the living quarters
right.
would be down there.
According to Mars One, 5 meters of, or about 16.4 feet of Martian soil would be equivalent to being protected by Earth's
atmosphere and magnetosphere.
Yeah. Sure.
So, I mean, it doesn't sound like it'd be a very comfortable experience. You'd be living underground on Mars with no way of getting back. Now,
however, I mean, you know, it's a lot of people, you know, applications have gone, you know. Everyone on the planet.
They've got at least 100,000 now.
Well, right? They say they have at least 100,000.
Oh, my.
Oh,
skeptic.
Actually,
skeptic in the room.
I read some criticism. It was something like they were counting applications that were started but not completed or something.
That's why I say they say.
Yeah.
It's almost like when they talk about when a technology company talks about how many units they've sold and they include all the units that they have shipped to retailers that haven't been sold to consumers. They've been sold to retail establishments.
Oh, okay.
But they count it as units sold.
Well, regardless, I would say that it's captured the public's imagination.
Right. But see, here's the point I was getting at before I went on my incredibly long tangent. So let's assume that they beat all the odds and somehow they manage to land these rovers, the capsules, everything works. They put it all together. The group of four get there. They've
no
built it all out.
No chess sets. No one has killed each other.
No one's killed each other. Everything's hunky-dory. The four people settle down for a long Martian nap. And the ratings for the TV show start to slip, and then the TV show doesn't receive the financial support that it once had. What happens to those people that we've put on Mars?
Yeah.
And what happens when the TV show goes away, when people stop buying Mars One trucker hats and T-shirts?
We're sorry, colonists. You have been canceled.
Right. Yeah. What do we do? You know, that's... There's a... Now we have a moral obligation, or at least an ethical obligation, to the people we have put on this planet to keep them alive.
Well, that's weird that you'd have an ethical obligation to people who were put there by a private enterprise.
Right.
You know, not by your government or something.
I also wonder, I mean, again, this is the skeptic in me. You've got a non-profit organization that's overseeing all of this, and there's the for-profit side that is designed to get all the money for it, and the non-profit side essentially has... like 95% controlling interest in this private enterprise. Essentially, the nonprofit is in charge of making sure that the funds go to where they need to go with research and development and all this kind of stuff. The skeptic in me worries that this. I would like to think that everyone's on the up and up, but the skeptic in me can't help but say, you know, if this were a scam, this is a heck of a scam. Where you've got a nonprofit organization that's essentially funneling all this money. So, I don't say that it's necessary. I mean, obviously for it to work, they would have to have the people involved. Otherwise, you don't have a product to sell. So, I would like to think that this is mostly on the up and up, but at the very least, I have to say, it seems overly optimistic, if not naive.
While we're on the negative side, I wanted to have another kind of dark concern I have about this is that, so we've talked about the inspiration factor that, you know, so many kids wanted to get into science and exploration and engineering and stuff because of the moon landing.
Yep.
And part of the benefit of the Mars One, if it succeeded and everything went according to plan, would be, oh yeah, so we can renew that. There's this new sense of adventure about going to space and kids are really inspired. Is it possible that there could be the opposite effect? Now, well, if you have a reality TV show where, assuming something bad happens, we're watching people slowly deteriorate in health over the course of 11 months until they all die, could that have a the opposite effect?
I would say yes.
Yeah,
I would say probably.
I think it certainly would. Yeah, it's... I agree that even if this were a project that just ultimately fails because it was too ambitious, like not, saying that everyone is sincere in their desire of fulfilling this project, if it fails because it was too ambitious and they don't have a lot to show for it, that could end up hurting it as well. I mean, it doesn't have to be a complete like disaster and end in the loss of human life for it to have a negative impact.
But then again, here we are naysaying, and we could have made a lot of these criticisms about the plan to put somebody on the moon within
a
decade.
Yeah,
I mean, that was incredibly ambitious.
Lots of people said that that would be impossible, that it would result in the death of astronauts, that that there was no point to it.
Yeah.
I want to
show prudence there. You know, I want to
say
like that I'm skeptical, but that if you're listening, people involved in Mars One, and you're really trying to do this, I mean, work on it. Yeah. I'm not trying to say stop.
I will say, if you are working for Mars One, that I find your approach to discussing the dangers of radiation to be a little cavalier.
Yeah.
For example, you remember when I mentioned that if you were between the ages of 25 and 34 and you spent, so if you're between those ages and you've spent a good amount of time in space, your chances for developing cancer, if you're male, increase by 10% and female by about 17%.
Mm-hmm.
And then Mars One's response to that is saying, this is quoting from their website, let's compare it to the people who do not go to Mars. In their lifetimes, men have a 12% chance of contracting prostate cancer and women have a 12.5% chance of developing breast cancer. That's in your lifetime.
Okay, also, one specific kind of cancer,
right.
Two specific kinds of cancer.
So we're talking, they're comparing a person's entire lifespan to the amount of time it would take just to go to Mars and then be exposed to that kind of radiation.
Yeah, 536 days.
So I think that is, at best, that's misinformation. At worst, it's completely disingenuous. And it misleads people into thinking that it's safer than it really is. And I'm sure that assuming that they are all on the up and up, that through the screening process and the training process, all of that information will become much more concrete for the people who are serious about pursuing this.
I'm sure it would be disclosed, yeah.
But on the face of it, it makes me uneasy.
Yeah, yeah, especially when you're charging for applications and you're inviting the whole world to apply.
Yeah.
It's a little bit squiggly.
Yeah, Jim Bob, you are going to go to Mars.
Plenty of people I would shoot.
Don't worry about cancer.
So are we ready to talk about some other options?
Please do.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about the moon and Mars, and those are the big ones,
yep.
I think. But our imagination doesn't have to stop there. I mean, it's possible that we could colonize other places in the solar system, too. And I wanted to talk about a few of those. And I want to start with one that's kind of counterintuitive, but for a strange reason, I think might be the most likely place, which would be asteroids. And
yeah,
the reason I think that is because asteroids have one of the most obvious financial incentives.
Sure, there could
for
be
colonization.
There could be.
They are chock full of cool stuff.
Yeah,
there are asteroids that could have a lot of metals that are in the platinum family, which are exceedingly rare on Earth.
Super rare on Earth, but not so much in asteroids. And they say like one asteroid could have more platinum group metals than have ever been mined on Earth so far.
Right.
And those are very expensive, you know, more expensive than gold usually.
And they're also incredibly useful. It's not just that they're pretty.
Yeah. I mean, we can use them in electronics. They're useful. Isn't platinum used in in fuel cells,
yeah,
right?
You can use platinum in fuel cells for catalysts so that you can have hydrogen-based fuel cells, I should say, because there are a lot of different kinds. But in hydrogen-based fuel cells, more often than not, the catalyst tends to be platinum.
Mm-hmm. So this is really useful, highly valuable, and so there's a financial incentive for people to work really hard and invest lots of money to get there and set up shop.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other side of that is that asteroids are they're not friendly to humans because they don't have an atmosphere and they don't have a magnetosphere. Some might be big enough to have a small magnetosphere. But,
right. And negligible gravity.
Not significant enough to protect us from radiation. So you'd still have that space radiation problem unless you were to drill down deep or have very protective coating.
Step one, hire mm-hmm. Bruce Willis. Step two.
Yeah. But it's all the same stuff we've been talking about there. You're exposed to radiation in a bad way. It's a low or microgravity environment, which is a pro and a con on asteroids. Number one, it's a pro because it makes it that much easier to land and take off.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a con because it has this negative effect on humans. And
right.
One of the pros also is that it might be much easier to build load-bearing structures like living quarters and stuff
sure,
on
sure.
the surface of an asteroid because of that low gravity. It would require, you know, just less material.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again, they're a little bit further out than the moon, so that can have a potential for...
Yeah,
launch patitude.
There are near Earth asteroids and there are main belt asteroids, mm-hmm. and so we've thought about both. It seems more likely to me that if we were to set up shop, it'd be on one of the bigger near Earth asteroids that they want to exploit.
Sure.
But also you could focus on main belt asteroids or even like the dwarf planet Ceres.
Wow.
Yeah. That's
gotta be a hostile environment.
Oh, mega. Yeah. But, like we've been saying, all these challenges are there, but these are other places we might look. Here's a really cool one I came across, which is, this is very fantastical. This is looking a long way in the future, not any near term. But I read a Universe Today article that interviewed this NASA scientist named Jeffrey Landis, and he talked about an interesting way of possibly colonizing Venus in the far future.
Venus, yeah. which can melt lead.
Yeah, the surface of which can melt lead, boil sulfur.
Sunscreen.
The surface of Venus has a pressure about 90 times that of Earth's atmosphere, so it's like a pressure that's not quite as much as the bottom of the deepest part of Earth's ocean, but like being at the bottom of some parts of the ocean.
I'm seeing here it has a mean surface temperature of 735 Kelvin, which is about 462 degrees Celsius or a balmy 863 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah, like we said, melts lead. So you drop your artillery shell and it's just liquid.
Yeah, all of your books catch fire.
Uh-huh.
But it's
not so much a plan and that anybody's going to do it real soon. Okay. But
concept.
He just talked about it as a sort of thought experiment, and it actually sounds really cool. So he had this idea that a balloon filled with breathable air would float in Venus's atmosphere because Venus's atmosphere is so thick.
Right.
So the density of this balloon full of air that we could breathe would float in Venus's atmosphere at a place where the atmospheric pressure is about one bar or one atmosphere.
Sure.
Which is totally livable for us. Just floating in the atmosphere by itself.
Are you telling me that he's talking about a floating colony?
He's talking about a floating cloud city.
On Venus.
Obviously we'd call it Bespin.
Bespin, exactly. Yeah, it would be Lando Calrissian's cloud city on Venus.
Colt 45. And
Yes, we've all seen that old ad, Billy Dee Williams and the Colt 45.
Yeah.
What does it say? He says, works every time.
Oh, dear.
60% of the time it works every time.
And so we'd all be chilling with Lando. But the cool thing about this is, so just imagine you would counteract a lot of these problems if you're in the atmosphere at this level. It would be a reasonable temperature at this level in the atmosphere because where this balloon would float would be comparable to Earth's atmosphere temperature. You would be safe from rapid decompression because the atmospheric pressure outside would be about the same as it would be inside. So you have all these cool benefits. Now, you would have some problems. Number one, like, how would you build this?
Yeah. Also, if I'm not mistaken, the clouds on Venus are made of sulfuric acid.
That's exactly right. And they would eat that. That's one of the main problems he identified. He thought that the hardest part of this would be making the balloon out of a material that's sturdy enough to hold it and keep it in place and not too heavy at the same time to sink it, but that would be sturdy enough to withstand the corrosive effects of the sulfuric acid that would build up on the outside of the balloon. Anyway, I think that's a really interesting idea. And then that, of course, leads to the other question. If you're talking about colonization, we're not necessarily talking about on the surface. So could we create floating cities in other gas planets, like the gas giants? The answer there is probably no, because gas giant like Jupiter just has massive radiation.
Stormy and radiated, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's Jupiter is just a death trap. it's way worse than just interplanetary radiation.
You thought Mars was hostile. You don't know anything yet.
Seriously, Jupiter, it's not just that you're lacking the protection of Earth, but you're subjecting yourself to additional radiation. And there's a huge gravity well, and that creates a big problem. But so could we colonize other planets? Well, here's one that's another weird option. What about Mercury? Well, you say, why would we colonize Mercury, and how could we do it? It's so hot. Mercury is actually not quite as hot as Venus.
Right.
But it's almost as hot, so why would you do that? Well, it turns out the polar regions of Mercury might be safe temperatures if you go straight to the North or South Pole. And another thing that's interesting is satellite data makes us think that there is probably water ice on the poles of Mercury.
Huh.
Which is a sort of a must-have
for
us.
Yeah, it's way up there on our list of things what we want.
Mm-hmm. And so you can get at this. There might be other volatiles that would be useful for us. And one of the big pluses of colonizing Mercury would be solar energy.
Okay.
Now, the surface of Mercury gets a huge amount of solar energy. It gets way more than the surface of the Earth does. And if you could set up shop on Mercury where you're collecting solar energy, you could create a ginormous surplus of energy that's useful in space.
Be way more effective than our Earth-based photovoltaics because of the proximity to. Sure.
Right. And so that's one big selling point of Mercury. And so some people have even said, like, if you go way, way into the future, I don't know if you've read about, like, some of the plans for creating like Dyson spheres. You ever heard of this concept? Where you would be creating just tons and tons of solar panels to harness all of the sun's energy, basically. A lot of these plans involve something basically like turning the planet Mercury into solar panels. Like you're just mining it to death.
Wow.
Of course, that's so far in the future. It's basically fantasy, but it's an interesting idea. So then there are a couple other places in the solar system we might look. I've already mentioned that Jupiter is kind of a death trap, but there are really cool reasons we might want to go to Europa.
Yeah, which is still pretty rough.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you're talking.
I'm not saying we want to go there like it'd be real nice. I'm saying there's a strong incentive.
It's not like Cancun, but
yeah, like there are the amount of lethal radiation you would receive in Jupiter is it's a huge amount, but only like 1/6 that on Europa, which is still pretty nasty stuff.
Oh, well, yeah. On one day of surface exposure on Europa, they say is a fatal dose of radiation for a human. So again, you'd need massive protection. So Europa, for those of you who don't know, that's a moon of Jupiter, and it's the place in the solar system that scientists are the most excited about life. They think that, okay, now Europa is covered in this icy crust, and underneath that icy crust, they're pretty sure there are vast oceans of liquid water. And they think in those oceans of liquid water, it's entirely possible that there is microbial life. We just don't know. But that's it.
Or based on the radiation, some kind of eldritch horror. Yeah. But either way,
Cthulhu has a summer home on Europa.
They think it's the best place to look. Mm-hmm. And so that's a really cool reason to go there. Of course, the drawback of that is one of the challenges to human colonization might be the same thing. Now, if there are alien microbes there,
that might be bad times.
Yeah,
it could be fine.
To be fair, yeah, the likelihood of alien and terrestrial biology being at all compatible in any way, so like for it to be sort of a bacteria or a virus kind of thing, is the likelihood is low because the development would have been so far separated that the chance of there being compatibility is also low.
Well,
although
I don't know.
It could still be toxic, though.
Oh, yeah.
So toxicity would still be an issue.
Oh, right,
but you wouldn't
right.
necessarily worry about catching some sort of weird European virus.
No. It would be more likely that it would be something like, the Europa version of Clostridium botulinum, which causes botulism, which, you know, is a neurotoxin that can kill on the magnitude of nanograms. So.
Yeah. Or you can use it to smooth out those wrinkles.
I don't know. It sounds like you're saying, like, you're sure that it wouldn't have a biochemistry similar to Earth life. I would say that we don't know.
That it would be separated by enough time that the likelihood of it having compatibility would be low.
I don't think I could comment on the likelihood. I don't know why we would know one way or another.
It could be a cool place.
Yeah.
Well, it would be because it's icy.
It's very cold.
Don't judge me, Lauren.
As we discussed before, Jupiter's radiation is completely nasty.
It's out of control.
People have talked about one way to protect ourselves if we were to set up a colony on Europa would be to drill under the ice.
And right.
Water is actually pretty good at shielding from radiation because of the hydrogen content in water. So if you drill deep enough in the ice, you would be protected on Europa, we think.
Yeah.
But
Jupiter has other moons too. I mean, there's Ganymede, which doesn't have nearly as much radiation as Europa does, and it has its own magnetosphere as well.
That's true, but there's not as much to do on Ganymede.
Have you ever been there? It is a slow place on a Saturday night, and it's only Thursday morning.
Ganymede's not a research prize like Europa is. Of course, there's also
Callisto.
Yeah, okay.
Which receives even less radiation to the point where, you know, maybe we don't have as much of a research base there, but it could be another launching pad for further deep space exploration.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about one more really cool possibility.
Okay.
And that's Saturn's moon Titan.
Right.
Have you all read about Titan?
Sure.
Titan's cool because it's sort of like planet oil, not oil, but hydrocarbons.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a planet that's full of, we think, methane and all these organic compounds, probably liquid lakes on the surface. And it has, it's the only moon, as far as I know, in our solar system that has a dense atmosphere.
Now, to be fair, when you say liquid lakes, we're talking liquid lakes of things like methane and ethane,
not
liquid water.
Well, no, they think there might be some water, but we're not talking about all water like Earth. Yeah, it'd be a lot of methane and stuff. So that's really cool, but it's freezing, it has low gravity, and let me talk about how cold it is. So the temperature on Titan's surface is about negative 289 degrees Fahrenheit. That's negative 178 degrees Celsius. And for some perspective, I just quickly looked up the lowest temperature ever recorded on Earth. That's ever recorded on Earth anywhere. That was a negative 128.6 degrees Fahrenheit or negative 89.2 degrees Celsius, and that was in Vostok Station in Antarctica.
Clearly, no measurement has ever been taken after I've told a really bad pun and Lauren has reacted. Because, let me tell you, there's no molecular movement in that room.
It's frosty.
The level of coldness is unimaginable. I mean, it's how cold this is. One thing they talked about is it's so cold that the atmosphere is just extremely thick. You know, it's kind of a soupy atmosphere. You could wear wings and fly, you know.
Although, you know, I'm sure that we could work out the heat management system if we, you know, had the technology to get there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's full of resources, and that's what's cool. I mean, it's like it's your interplanetary gas station.
Well, yeah. Well, some of the outer planets may have lots of resources that would be very useful to us. It's just the question of, is there any way of getting there and getting the resources to where we would need them in a way that makes sense? Like Uranus might have lots of helium-3 on it, but to get out there and to get back would take a monumental effort. So,
on the other hand, I would not recommend colonizing anywhere near Neptune because that's where Event Horizon happens. And if you've seen it, you should know
that
it goes
very, very poorly.
Yeah, so you don't do that.
Okay. Well, you know, I don't have any problem going to Mars despite Mars attacks, but I think that wraps up our discussion here. So the interesting thing here is that I don't think we're going to be abandoning these dreams of colonization anytime soon. And I really hope that we're able to see, live to see some of these come to fruition. And while we do feel skeptical about the Mars One initiative, maybe that is the one that works out. You know, it's too early for us to say. It may very well be that the ingenuity and determination of the people who are on that program are up to the challenge of getting people on the planet and having them survive. And really, if they are, we're going to find out so many amazing things that it's just going to be a boon for all of mankind, really.
Yeah, whenever we go, and I think we will, it will be. It'll be pretty rad.
It's going to be pretty awesome. Yeah. So, I mean, I certainly hope it works out. You know, don't let our skepticism translate into us being like, we shouldn't try. I think all of us believe we should try. We just want to make sure that every effort that is made is our best effort.
Right.
Yeah.
I think at a certain point, the trying is even more important than
whether we succeed or not. Yeah. And the only
in an immediate sense. Yeah.
The only concerns I have, of course, are for people's safety. That's paramount, obviously. And then to make sure that nothing we do ends up discouraging future generations from trying.
Right.
Look at how they mucked it up. Let's just go to the bar. I don't want that to happen. So we're going to sign off on this episode. But if you guys have anything to say about colonization in space, what you think are the best approaches, what you think is the most likely scenario, or if you think it's just ridiculous, you should let us know. I want to hear everything. Let us know. Send us an email. Our address is fwthinking@discovery.com or go to fwthinking.com. That's where you're going to find all the podcasts, the blog posts, the videos, links to supporting articles that give more information about this kind of stuff. We think you're really going to like it, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. This week, I'm talking to the one and only Ryan Seacrest.
Love the connection to people. I think at the core, what I get excited about, what gets me up in the morning, is connecting with people in an unscripted, unvarnished way. It's getting to say something to them, hear back from them, know that I'm part of the routine. And I look forward to getting on the air. I look forward to it.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.